You've heard it a lot. Our country is polarized. There's a rise of a populist core stoked by grievances. How'd we get here? It's a question many of us have asked aloud, and it's one that sent journalist Ben Bradford on a quest in search of an answer. And he zeroes in on one period of time, one campaign 50 years ago, where he discovers some roots of our current political climate. The podcast is called Landslide.
Those are the seeds of the culture war.
The nature of American conservatism was being deliberately changed.
I am not frightened by what lies ahead, and I don't believe the American people are frightened by what lies ahead.
That, of course, is the sound of Ronald Reagan, who we'll talk a lot about with Ben Bradford, a host of the podcast. Ben, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
Let's go to the history you explore. The Ronald Reagan of the 1960s you describe as a political lightweight, but he seizes on messages that conservatives in the Republican Party see as an opportunity for them to gain influence in the party. What resonates in the Reagan of that early time?
Reagan, how he rises from someone with no political experience, which was just unheard of at the time in high-profile races, to becoming governor of California, ultimately challenging for the presidency against Gerald Ford in 1976. And it's fascinating to go back to look at how he was viewed. He was viewed as extreme, fringe, radical. This person whose views that the government was going to imminently fall into totalitarianism because of the Great Society, because of civil rights legislation, put him out of step with the mainstream. But Reagan runs for governor in 1966 against this powerful incumbent who was running for a third term, Pat Brown. And he seizes on a coalition that I think is something we recognize today, but didn't recognize it so much at the time. And that is that he seizes these cultural issues and social issues. He hits law and order at a time when there are race riots happening in Los Angeles. He attacks the counterculture, the hippies, the liberals on college campuses. And he sort of says, we can go back to simpler times. You know, these are the problems of our society. It's not the economic issues. This is the problem, is the social issues.
And how does that take on the core of the Republican Party? Because as you say, Reagan is still on the outside.
So the political parties of the time, they may have had the same names as we do now, but functionally we're talking about different beasts. The Republican Party and the Democratic Party were not ideological organizations. They were not divided left and right. There were main differences on economic issues writ large. The Republican Party was the party of business. The Democrats were sort of the party of labor, the party of the New Deal. But on foreign policy and certainly on social issues, there just wasn't that big of a divide. A greater portion of Republicans voted for the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act than did Democrats. So those divisions didn't exist. And what you start to see is a coalition being built where it's based on those divisions. And the other thing that's important to understand is just how outlandish that seemed at the time, that that could be done. You know, the New York Times, by the time that Reagan is challenging Gerald Ford for the nomination, a columnist is writing, Reagan has no chance at getting the nomination unless you suspect the party of, quote, suicidal tendencies. So that's the view. And essentially what we're doing in Landslide is tracing how that changes and how does this person who is considered, you know, so fringe that his nomination would be suicidal wins a landslide.
Yeah. And there's Republican operatives on Gerald Ford's side at the time as they're starting to see this and they call them right wing nuts, right? Those are Ford's operatives' words. So there's a key moment. In 1976, Reagan is running for the Republican nomination, and he brings up this obscure foreign policy issue, the Panama Canal, that one advisor describes as Reagan's America First moment.
It took on a proportion well beyond itself because it touched upon a little bit of what we now think of as America First.
Talk about that moment, that obscure foreign policy issue, and how it became so important.
The Panama Canal is very much the build the wall of 1976. And what I mean by that is this issue that at the beginning of the race, most people in the country have never heard of, have never thought about, they have no opinion on it. In the words of another Reagan advisor, who knew anything about frickin' Panama, is what he said to me. And it ultimately takes over the race for the Republican primary, the closest presidential primary race we've ever had, which is between Ford and Reagan. And so for decades and decades, resentment had grown among Panamanians that the U.S. was operating this lucrative canal. From both political parties, the conventional wisdom was that the best thing to do is to make sure to hand over the Panama Canal back to Panama. Because otherwise, you're going to have riots, you're going to have bloodshed, the canal is going to close, commerce is going to shut down, this sort of vital artery of business is going to shut down. Except Reagan
right?
comes out with this very catchy slogan.
When it comes to the canal, we bought it, we paid for it, it's ours, we're going to keep it.
That resonates with people. And I think understanding why it resonates is really the Rosetta Stone for understanding what is happening in this era. In the 1970s, after the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act, we're talking about the women's movement, the gay and lesbian rights movement. And you see all of this organized backlash against these movements, a coalition deliberately being formed to essentially change the political parties. And when Reagan starts talking about the Panama Canal, you talk to his advisors and they'll tell you, you know, it is a symbolic issue. And what it really speaks to is this idea of nationalism, right? They want a return to the past. And Reagan is very explicit that that is what he stands for. So it is a culture war campaign. And the Panama Canal, even after the election, becomes the biggest issue for fundraising for these conservative groups known as the New Right. Until by 1980, they're the biggest outside spenders in U.S. elections.
And in your podcast, and we can't get into all of it, but you describe this political scaffolding of money, the role of the religious right, evangelicals, who suddenly become much more political than they had been. I mean, you're explaining how Reagan tapped into nationalism. You also use the word grievance a lot. How does he tap into grievance?
Reagan is winning the South, specifically courting voters who had previously supported Alabama Governor George Wallace, the Democrat, who in his inaugural speech for governor said, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. So it is people who are angry about the changing culture and see an ability to turn back the tide.
Yeah. I mean, this political history, as you tell the story, and as many of us know, has racial dog whistles. You know how Democrat Jimmy Carter once leveraged that in his career, but certainly Reagan. How did that play into how conservatives really helped to take over the Republican Party?
Well, again, you had this division in the Democratic Party. Southern Democrats, who had been Democrats since the Civil War, they were called yellow dog Democrats. They'd rather vote for a yellow dog than for a Republican. After the Civil Rights Act, Republicans, starting with Barry Goldwater, who was crushed in a landslide to Lyndon Johnson, but won some southern states. They start to court these voters. And Reagan is very, very good at this. Reagan opposes the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and fair housing in California. And he does all of this as government overreach, saying, well, of course, we all want equality, but I just wonder how much the federal government can do in this regard.
And taking it to today, how do these ingredients you lay out and you explore, how do they have staying power?
We look at our political divide and we see, particularly on the Republican side, these changes to the party. We see the rise of Donald Trump, who came to power by saying things like build the wall, which sounded so outlandish at the time, but ended up in the Republican Party platform, who implemented a Muslim ban, who did these things that seemed very ahistorical at the time. But essentially, by tracing the formation of this coalition that resurrects the Republican Party. So you have to understand, the Republican Party in the mid-1970s is essentially left for dead. People think it's going to, quote, go the way of the Whigs, you know, that it's done. It has 18% of voters affiliated with it after Watergate. So this is the resurrection of the Republican Party. And how did that happen? And it happened by assembling this coalition that was specifically focused on culture war. When we follow that through line, today looks a lot more understandable.
Yeah, we've been talking to Ben Bradford, writer, reporter, and executive producer of the new podcast, Landslide. Ben, thanks for the time.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.